Well, I have quite an institution here, and there are about 100,000 people a year come here, and oh, twice that many. The youngsters don't have to pay admission. And when we have a section of the population interested in some special thing, for instance, just now we talked with the farm agents of the United States. The auditorium back there must have had 350 people in it from every county in the United States. And I discussed with them the history of the country and the presidency and what they have to do to keep it like it is. And never a day goes by that I don't see anywhere from 10 to a dozen people, and sometimes more than 100, on conditions of that sort. All of them interested in the government of the United States and how it runs, and I try to tell them from my experience how it does.
Well, you seem to take a lot of time and patience with it.
Well, I like it. I like it. I think one of the best things that a man can do where he has been in public service is to let people understand his experience and what it takes to make that experience worthwhile.
You have a lot of mail and you answer a lot of letters. What is your average mail?
Oh, I'd say that we answer anywhere from 50 to 150 a day.
People write to you about everything, don't
everything
they?
Everything under the sun.
Can you name some of the things?
Well, yes. There are a great many people that want me to help them get certain days and weeks set aside for use. And some of them, to me, are ludicrous, but they're not to the people who ask for them. Sometime I'll publish a list of all the days and weeks I've been asked to take a hand in, particularly since I've been out of the White House, when they think I can have more influence than I have now. And then they want to know about things in the government. And a great many of them want jobs, which I'm in no position to give them now, although I always give them a courteous answer and tell them the person I think that can be of help to them. And we have questions about various phases of the government. And wherever I can give them an answer that'll do them any good, I try to do it. And if I can't give the answer, I tell them where they can go and get the information.
One more question in that line. You keep in touch with a good many of your former colleagues in the Senate, in the government.
Oh, yes.
People
who
have worked with you.
Oh, yes. I'm in constant correspondence with a great many of the people who were with me in the government and with a great many of the members of Congress and the heads of departments where something of vital interest to some person is at stake, I'll write him a letter and send a copy of it to the head of that department.
Do you have many people in government write to you about your views on certain legislation, pieces of legislation or basic issues for
the
country?
Yes, a great many of them do that, and I just give them a frank viewpoint on the subject. And. If it doesn't fit in with what they believe is right, why, that's all right. That's their privilege. Take it or leave it if they like.
Many people who run for public office are seeking your support and backing?
Yes, that's true all over the country. And I can't accommodate them to save my life because there are too many of them. But especially is that true of people who want to overturn local city or county government. They always write to me and ask me how to do it, and I hardly ever tell them anything on that line. I tell them that they'll have to use their own judgment about the situation at home, that I can't enter into local affairs.
Now, you've also been in close touch with minority groups since you left the White House.
That's true. I'm going to address the Negro Baptist Convention this evening.
That these people continually petition you for your support and guidance?
Well, not so much support and guidance as they like to have a conversation from me if they can get me on a platform.
Are there any special minority groups that seek you out, or are they all represented in
nearly everyone you can name is represented, as well as majority groups. I talk to more Democrats than any other organization.
But you also hear occasionally from Republicans, do you not?
Yes, I have some very, very cordial letters from Republicans. I had one just the other day stating the fact that he'd been here and seen what we had to offer, and that he was sorry he was not acquainted with me in 1948. He might have voted for him.
Now, isn't it a fact that a great many businessmen and heads of industry, since your retirement, have been expressing themselves to you in a cordial and appreciative manner?
Yes, that's true. That's true. They all understand, make a difference which side of the fence they're on, whether Republican or Democrat, laborer, or the head of a department in a great organization. They all understand that all in the world that I've ever tried to do is to work for the benefit of all the people in the country, and they're beginning to find that out now at this late date.
How many presidents, Mr. President, who have lived on after their terms have seen their course better understood since they left office? Have there been many? Not too many.
I think most of them who lived after they had been in the White House and had been responsible as the chief executive of the nation found that to be true. Very few of them did live very long afterwards. Grover Cleveland and Calvin Coolidge and President Hoover's lived longer than any of them, and I'm hoping that I'll top him when the time comes, because he's 10 years older than I am.
The president of IBM made a special call on you.
Yes, that's right.
What did he say to you?
Well, he was interested in the welfare of the country and was anxious for me to understand that he was just like every other citizen. He wanted to see the country prosper. And, of course, naturally, he wanted his own outfit to prosper, too, maybe a little more than he did the country.
As an internationalist, didn't he go to particular lengths to express his appreciation of how you managed to contribute to a world order of free nations?
Yes, he did, but then I didn't want to bring that up. That'd be bragging on myself, which I'm not good at.
Well, Mr. President, have you kept in touch with men like Churchill and other international figures with whom you'd had dealings when you were president?
Yes, I have had a great deal of correspondence with Prime Minister Churchill and with President de Gaulle of France, with Mr. Spock, who's the head of NATO and who was Prime Minister of Belgium at one time while I was in the White House. I've been in constant touch with most of those people all the time since I left the White House.
Okay. And Attlee came here to visit you.
Attlee came to the United States and paid me a visit, and we had a very pleasant time.
But didn't you miss the enormous resource of information that you had at the White House at your disposal, and what came later?
Oh, yes. Yes, you see, the Central Intelligence Agency was organized at my direction by Admiral Leahy and Admiral Sowers, who is now the head of the General American Insurance Company in St. Louis, and two or three other very able and distinguished men like that. And we finally wound up by having Alan Dulles, who was the president of the brother of Foster Dulles, in charge of it. And he's a very able public servant and has been in touch with me since then. Of course, he can't furnish me with the reports because it's his business to keep the president informed. But that's one of the greatest services that's possible. You know, we have four or five departments, state and defense, every branch of defense, and agriculture and the Commerce Department, all with foreign connections. And they used to get stacks of messages 3 feet high, and the president had no way of finding out what was in those messages unless he read them all. That couldn't be done. So the Central Intelligence Agency coordinates the information that comes to every department as well as to the president and the State Department, and in that way the president has a viewpoint that no other man in the world has or can get.
Now, how do you form your opinions about issues and things in the absence of that kind of information?
Well, I read a great many newspapers in whom I had very little confidence when I had a Central Intelligence Agency, and talk to everybody that I have an opportunity to, and when I really get to the point where I want some honest-to-goodness information, I write to representatives in Congress and to representatives that I know in the State Department, and they give me the information.
This is information available to them, but not necessarily available, the kind of information that used to be available to you as president.
No, and I don't want that sort of information. I've had it offered to me, and I didn't want to make use of it, because it's best to have the information that's available to the whole public, and then you can say what you please and do what you please. When you have confidential information, you have to keep your mouth shut, and I don't like to do that.
Well, at any rate, because of your past experience, you're better able to judge those events which are going on.
Oh, yes, indeed. Whenever I see an article in some of the great newspapers, and I read three or four of them, on some subject, for instance, in Asia or Africa or South America, I can evaluate that better than a person who hasn't had the Central Intelligence information.
In other words, you keep yourself informed, but you also have a built-in guard against being misinformed.
That's the point, exactly. We don't want to be misinformed.
Do you depend upon any special occupational groups for constant contact?
No, I talk to all of them. I talk to labor and management and every other section of the population, and they all have information that's interesting, but you have to be very careful to coordinate the whole thing and see what the balance is.
Could we talk now a bit about your European trip to get a very quick sketch of some of the talks that you've had with some of the people over there?
During your first trip to Europe?
That was the trip in 1956.
I saw, sir.
Well, I had a very, very pleasant time. I had Mrs. Truman and I had luncheon with the Queen of England and the Duke of Edinburgh at Buckingham Palace, and we had a very, very pleasant conversation about our relationship with the British people. And I had lunch with Sir Winston Churchill at his country place, and spent quite a bit of time there, and Lord Beaverbrook was present, and we discussed all the angles of the situation at that time. And over in France, I had a dinner with the Prime Minister of France at that time. And with the Foreign Minister, I had a chance to talk very frankly, because he spoke better English than I do, and we got along in fine shape. He sat for me at the dinner. And then in Italy, I called on the President of Italy, and on the Prime Minister of Italy came to see me. And we had an argument about whether there were 21 or 22 amendments to the Constitution of the United States. And then I had a...
That was with the Chief Justice.
I also saw the Chief Justice, and he's the one with whom I had the argument about how many amendments there were to the Constitution of the United States. It's all friendly. Then we had a very pleasant visit with Pope Pius XII. I went there for a 15-minute interview and stayed almost an hour, and discussed all the angles of the situation as he could see them from his position. And he has the best arrangement to hear of things all around the world, and anybody in the world, I judge, except maybe the President of the United States and the heads of states of France and Great Britain. And then I went to Belgium and had a very, very pleasant dinner with Spock, who at that time I think was Foreign Minister. I'm not sure. I think that he was Foreign Minister at the time when I was there. Then we went to call on the Queen of the Netherlands, and she had us at her country place for luncheon, and we spent a most pleasant time with her and discussed all the things that you'd think about in that part of Europe, and then went on to Germany, and had, in fact, we went to Germany first, and I had luncheon with the President of Germany and dinner with Chancellor Adenauer. Both of those men struck me as being very able persons, and we discussed the German situation from start to finish. I haven't talked about those things because most of the information that I received was in confidence, and I haven't used it public at all and don't intend to.
Now, none of these things, could you tell us what transpired when you visited the Queen and the Duke at Windsor?
Well, we had a luncheon around a table in their private apartments, and there were present to us the Queen and the Duke and Mrs. Truman and myself and Ambassador Woodward and Mrs. Woodward. And we discussed things around the table just like you would at any other luncheon.
How about the glass of wine? The glass of wine. Who paid for a glass of wine?
I don't remember.
Remember he spilled it?
Oh, yes. Well, things happen at the royal table that happen everywhere. The Duke knocked over a glass of wine. Nobody paid any attention to it, only to laugh.
Any reminder of your visit or your reception of the princess when she came to the National Airport and what happened at that time?
Well, the princess and Duke came to visit the President of the United States, and they came directly from Canada, and they'd been briefed and rebriefed and briefed again. And the princess was is a lovely person, and she was somewhat worried about what she should say to the people who were gathered at the airport to see her. And I escorted her to the platform and told her to go ahead and say whatever she pleased, that everybody was interested in her welfare. And from then on, she was not nervous. We had to put a special cushion in the big old car in which we had to ride uptown so that she would be on a level with the president when we rode through the crowds. But we had a most remarkable visit. We decided that we'd call in all the youngsters, the children of the cabinet members. There were about 100 of them.
Mm.
And she said that she would be very happy to meet all of them. And when they were preparing for this reception, she asked Margaret to come over. She was in the Lee House. We were in the Blair House. That's where the White House had been rehabilitated. And she asked Margaret if she should wear her tiara. And Margaret told her if she didn't, she was going to disappoint a whole lot of youngsters in Washington, so she wore it. We had a most pleasant breakfast the next morning with nobody present but just the princess and the Duke and the family. And she said that was the most pleasant breakfast she had on the whole trip.
Looking back now at your visit with Eisenhower, what was your feeling about the man and his role in
Oh, he impressed me as being one of the ablest persons I'd ever met. He knew the score from every angle. And we talked on every subject nearly, as it affected Germany and the Berlin airlift and things of that sort. And when we went to leave that evening, we caught a train about dark. And he came down to the station with us, and I was told by the head of the Associated Press Service there that that's the first time Eisenhower had ever escorted anybody to the station, no matter what his rank was.
Do you believe that he truly spoke for the new Germany that is to be?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think if there ever was an honest man, he's it. And he knows what the score is, and his interest is the peace of the world and the welfare of his own country.
Did you feel that there was a new Germany in the making?
Yes, I did. I did. I was satisfied when I left there that with Eisenhower at the head of the government, there was no danger in the world as far as Germany was concerned, except to cooperate.
And that it was a one-man performance, or was it representing the intent and feeling of a new Germany?
And I think that's what it was, because the president had made the same impression on me that the then president of Germany. And nearly all the Germans I met, all the officials, impressed me the same way. But Eisenhower was the top one because he seemed to know more about it than all the rest of them put together. And I think he did.
On your second trip to Europe, at the time when de Gaulle was about to move into power and then did move into power, you were invited, I understand, by him to go up and see him, but...
Yes, I was, but I told him, I got to talk to him personally, that I was only over there just for a few days and a few weeks rest, and that I was not making any public appearances, and that I didn't want to do anything that would in any way embarrass him and what he was trying to do. He said he understood it, and that's all there was to it.
What is your feeling about de Gaulle?
I think de Gaulle has made a wonderful impression on the French, and I think he's doing his level best to pull the government into a position where it'll make France a great power once more. If he can carry out his program, I'm sure that'll happen.
How did you talk to de Gaulle personally? Did he telephone you or did he send...
He sent a messenger to see me.
Yes.
And then I talked to him over the telephone. He speaks fairly good English.
And,
as good English as I do French, and I don't speak any French.
But you understood each other,
yes,
and he understood what you wanted to say to him.
Yes, he understood it.
And why did he
had a, we had interpreters teach in, so that it, there's no doubt about the understanding.
Did you want to avoid association or involvement with de Gaulle at a critical time, or did
No, I didn't want to do anything to embarrass him. Now, I wasn't over there for anything but to sit down and rest. And if I had taken any... had any public appearances, whatever, in any one of the countries, I'd have had to go to all of them, and I didn't want to do that. We were just going to spend a short time in France, and did, and had no public appearances, whatever, of any kind.
Then, of course, you were very meticulous not to make any speeches or do anything at all which might be interpreted either as trying to undermine or to criticize Eisenhower.
No, I made no public statements whatever that in any way reflect on the government of the United States or any other government in the world.
Did any of the heads of state that you saw express to you any deep concern about the survival of Western civilization?
They were all worried about it, and I guess they still are. The object of NATO was to prevent the subversion of the governments of the free world. And I think they're in just as much danger now as they were then.
What did the Pope especially find himself concerned with?
He was very much concerned, of course, about the Catholic prelates that were being mistreated by the communists, particularly in Yugoslavia and Poland.
Did he feel that that the Catholic Church was not getting enough support from the Western governments?
We didn't get into that phase of the thing. What I was trying to find out was what he could hear that was taking place behind the Iron Curtain, and his statement on the prelates who were in trouble was the result of that question, that he was not in position now to get the information that he formerly had from those countries.
He did not know what went on in Russia, Poland, Hungary?
Not as he had before. That he said the information that came was not as reliable as it was when their people were allowed to send messages out from behind the Iron Curtain, and they couldn't do it at that time. I don't suppose they can now.
Did he touch upon South America at all and what was going on down
there? No, he didn't discuss South America at all.
In all of your talks with any of the statesmen on this trip, was there any question raised about the atomic bomb or about nuclear warfare?
No, we didn't discuss that. We didn't discuss that at all.
Was there?
At that time, 1956, we were far superior to any other country in the control of that situation. And we didn't talk about it at all. I didn't think it was a proper thing for me to discuss because I was just a private citizen, a retired farmer, in fact, taking a trip.
What were the opinions expressed about the government of the United States? This is not going in, but it's important to have it in the record. The government of the United States since your leaving the White House, were they feeling less secure, more trouble?
Well, that would be really a political question, but they were. I'm sorry to say it.
Now, you ran into Nehru in London, and something happened in your discussions with him during the visit.
I had a very pleasant visit with Nehru. In fact, I went out and called on him at the Indian Embassy, and we had a very, very pleasant visit. And he then indicated to me that his viewpoint on the communist situation was changing. He didn't have the same peace-at-any-price attitude at that time. And I think it's been very well brought home to him now that he was on the right road, because now he's in trouble, sure enough, with the commies in China and Russia both.
Did he tell you why he was undergoing this change?
Oh, no, we didn't get into the details of the thing. I just judged that from the conversations I had with him on how things were in India. He indicated to me that he was very much worried about the northern border. This was long for the Tibet thing. And that He didn't know exactly what the outcome was going to be, but as usual, hoped for peace. And so did I, but then I told him there's one way to get peace with the Russians, and that's to be stronger than they are.
He didn't subscribe to that.
I didn't say a word to that.
the feeling toward the United States was warm and cordial all through that period?
Just as cordial as it could be. I had the same sort of a reception in every one of those places where we went. In fact, they mobbed us in Paris. It took a half a dozen gendarmes and police to get us through the crowd. The same thing happened, would have happened in Rome, only they were more careful there. In Belgium, it was going through Brussels. It was just like it was when I was on the way to Potsdam. The same sort of a reception. The same thing was true at Bonn and everywhere else we stopped. In Munich, also, we went to the birthplace of Beethoven, and they had to have a police guard in order to get in and out of the place.
Did any of them want to talk to you about FDR at all?
All of them mentioned FDR, and they all expressed a very strong fondness for him everywhere I went.
What in particular do they remember about FDR's relationship to them?
Well, the fact that he had come to the relief of Europe at the time when they needed it most, and they talked about the Atlantic Charter and the preliminaries to the United Nations, and then they were very happy that it had worked out as it had, and due to the preliminary arrangements, the forming of the United Nations and the feeding and rehabilitation of Europe and the countries that had been devastated, enemy and other kind, made them feel very kindly toward the United States.
I think we better take the next business tomorrow morning.
Yes, I think so.
No, not yet. I was just going to say that this is the end of the conference for Tuesday afternoon, September 8th.
Very well done.
This is a continuation of tape number 2, Wednesday, September 9. Mr. President, Mr. Hillman, and Mr. Noyes participating.
No, it wasn't. It isn't on. All right, you were talking pretty close to it.
Okay. I think it's more. Anyway, I'll say it over again, so.
This is a continuation of tape number 2, September 9, Wednesday, 1959. The President, Mr. Hillman, Mr. Noyes participating.
Why don't we get to the leadership
yes,
that you were talking about?
You want to ask me the question to you about yesterday. Just to say that
what happens to the leadership of the party when you have a surviving former president and a newly nominated candidate for the presidency by the convention?
We discussed that yesterday, and I was thinking seriously about examples. There's one in particular. In 1896, William J. Bryan was nominated as the Democratic candidate for president. And at that time, Grover Cleveland indicated that he'd be willing to be a candidate. He was a former president living at Princeton University at that time. But Bryan was accepted by the Democratic Party as the leader of the party. And he was nominated again in 1904. And then the conservatives decided that they would show that he was entirely wrong, and they nominated Alton B. Parker in 1904. And he was decidedly defeated. Then Bryan was nominated again in 1908, and he continued to be the leader of the Democratic Party until Woodrow Wilson was nominated, and Bryan was one of those who caused the nomination of Woodrow Wilson. And I can go back and talk about James E. Blaine under the same circumstances, but we won't do it now.
Who was present at that time? Who was the leader of the party during James Blaine's administration?
Well, you see, James E. Blaine was nominated, I think, at the same time that Hayes was, and they decided on Hayes. And then Blaine became a candidate in 1880, and Grant came very near being nominated in 1880. He had more votes on the first ballot than anybody else. And then Garfield was nominated as President of the United States, and he was assassinated about 4 months after he became president. And the vice president became president. But everybody always looked to James G. Blaine as the leader of the Republican Party, which he was at that time.
But don't we have a unique situation in 52? In 52, in November, the Democrats nominated a man you wanted nominated for the presidency.
That's right.
You continued in office for some time after that. We had a kind of a peculiar period when you were president of the United States, a Democrat, leader of the party, and you had a nominee. What happened during that period?
Well, every effort was made during that period to get the nominee elected as president of the United States. And the vice president became president. But everybody always looked to James G. Blaine as the leader of the Republican Party, which he was at that time.
But don't we have a unique situation in 52? In 52, in November, the Democrats nominated a man you wanted nominated for the presidency.
That's right.
You continued in office for some time after that. We had a kind of a peculiar period when you were president of the United States, a Democrat, leader of the party, and you had a nominee. What happened during that period?
Well, every effort was made during that period to get the nominee elected as president of the United States. It failed, principally because the nominee didn't have his whole heart in the support of democratic principles. He had listened to the advertising propaganda which had been put out by BBDNO, and was the man who started the rumor of the mess in Washington in a speech out in Oregon. And then, of course, the Republicans took that up and made everything they could out of it, and we could never in the world get that nominee to understand that when he runs on the Democratic ticket after a Democratic administration, it's his business to see that the Democratic administration has been endorsed and that the people understand what it's all about. That's what caused all the trouble. And in 1956, long before the nominating convention came up, I was anxious that he should come out and assert his leadership. He didn't do it. He still was coy and wanted to be forced to run at that time, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. Only when I went to Chicago and I'd heard that he thought I was an albatross around his neck, I tried to take that albatross off, but it didn't do any good. He was still defeated, but I supported him both times when he ran.
Well, Mr. President, how can you be a little bit more specific? Did you have a conversation with him in which you indicated that you would step out of his way if he thought...
Well, sure. Yes, I did.
Where was that, Mr. President?
That happened at the convention in Chicago.
In 56?
In 56, that's right. But didn't do any good. He was nominated, all right, and I got out and tore my shirt for him, and on those two campaigns, in 52 and 56, the only time that the president was ever discourteously treated was during those two campaigns. And that was brought about by the fact that the Republicans paid the youngsters 50 cents apiece to go down to the train and be disrespectful to the president. And I met a Catholic priest over in the middle of Ohio who ran these 50-cent kids off the platform because they were disrespectful to the president, and he was for Eisenhower.
Well, Mr. President, may I ask you, didn't you have a conversation or a breakfast with Stevenson in Chicago in which you told him that you felt that he had a wrong impression of you? Could you say anything
about
that conversation?
That meeting took place. Whether it was a breakfast or not, I can't remember. And I told him that if I was in any way a detriment to him, I'd get out of the way because I want a Democratic president of the United States.
I think you have in mind the meeting that the president had with Governor Stevenson at the Blackstone Hotel after you came back from Europe, and the purpose of the meeting was not only that, but to fill him in on what you had observed in Europe and what you thought were to be the big coming issues. Now,
that's
what did
correct.
You tell him about that, sir?
Well, I told him everything I had learned on the trip and told him that the United States was still considered the savior of the free world. And I don't know whether it had any impression or not.
But you also indicated to him, I recall you talking about it, that the coming issue for the United States, for the party, was the peace issue, and that he had to identify himself with the peace issue.
That's correct. But instead of that, he made statements that no further experiments should be made with the hydrogen or atomic bomb. And I didn't fall into that because I think that the only way in the world that the Russians can understand an approach is when you're stronger than they are. And the reason for the development of the hydrogen bomb was to put us in a position where we are ahead of the Russians.
And Mr. President, that there has been some consideration given to the fact, however, that Eisenhower, being a popular war hero, did have a certain advantage when he ran in 52.
Well, of course, a war veteran who runs for president, Taylor and Grant and Eisenhower are shining examples, always has the inside track. They wear a golden halo until they turn it into brass.
But nevertheless, you feel that if Stevenson hadn't messed up the approach...
If Stevenson had been willing to endorse the policies of Franklin Roosevelt and myself, regardless of what the advertising people had to say, I think he possibly may not have been elected, but he could have got at least 3 or 4 million more votes than he did in 1952, and same's true in 56.
To get more personal, if I may, in terms of your impressions of Stevenson, you went out for him in 52, you saw him in action, and then you developed a reluctance about him in 56. What caused you to have that reluctance?
Because
about him?
He would not say what he wanted to do. He didn't accept the leadership of the Democratic Party. Had he accepted the leadership of the Democratic Party long before the convention of 1956, it would have been no trouble to build him up, just as it would have been no trouble to build him up if he'd have been willing to start from January 1952 instead of 2 or 3 days before the convention. Couldn't get him to do it. He didn't know whether he was going to run or not. He wasn't in complete sympathy with what the Democrats stand for, and that's what caused the trouble.
Now, did you get the feeling that he justifiably had the reputation of being an expert in foreign affairs?
Well, I didn't know about that. It wasn't necessary for a man to be expert in foreign affairs to be president of the United States. The way to be elected president of the United States is to be an expert in domestic affairs. And then he can take the foreign situation and work it out, because he's the man who makes the foreign policy. And when he has all the information, he can do it without any trouble.
Do you mean that any person, even lacking in understanding of foreign policy, could become an able administrator of our foreign affairs once he became president?
I think I'm a shining example of it.
Well, we challenge that.
Yes.
We challenge that.
Well,
you were a student of history.
You knew what was going on, and you certainly had a
Well, I kept up with it, of course. And everybody, anyone who is interested in being a candidate for president ought to know exactly what's going on around the world from start to finish. And most of them do.
Well, to get more specific about Stevenson, did you have any serious misgivings about his grasp of domestic affairs?
Yes, I did. And I didn't find that out until the campaign started. He was a wonderful governor of Illinois. And the only prospect in sight when I decided not to run for re-election. And I had no idea then that the Republicans would nominate a soldier. We thought they'd nominate Taft or someone like that, and that it would be not too hard to elect a Democratic president. But conditions changed, and we didn't get that done.
Now, just to throw you back a little bit to those moments in Key West when you were meditating with yourself, mostly about your own plans, whether you were going to stand for re-election in 52 and whom you were going to try to persuade to run if you elected not to run. What was going through your mind at that time?
Well, I was thinking about the 30 years I had put in public service. And I wanted to quit while I was physically able to go ahead and do some things I wanted to do in the private life. And I studied the situation and considered all the Democrats in sight, and after much consultation decided that Stevenson was the man. Then I asked him to come see me, which he did, at the Blair House in, I think, January 28th or 29th. And we discussed the thing for an hour and a half. And he refused. He said he had to run for governor of New York, or governor of Illinois again. Well, 30 days after that, on February 28th, I think it was, he came back to see me. We had another discussion at the same place, at the same time. Had to slip in the back door so nobody would see what was going on. The same answer. And then in March, I got the National Democratic Chairman, Frank McKinney, to go and see him. And he gave him the same answer, that he would not, under any circumstances, run. Well, on Thursday, when the Democratic Convention was in session, after Senator Barkley had withdrawn, he called me up at the White House and told me that his friends wanted to nominate him for president. Would I object to it? Well, I blew up and talked to him in language I think he'd never heard before, and told him that since January 28th, 1952, I'd tried to get him to be the candidate for the Democratic Party, and of course I'd support him. And then the convention got tied up, and we had to get on a plane, and that's the first time that a picture of a plane taken off was seen on the plane itself, and flew to Chicago, got all the people involved into conference, and he was nominated. And then he went out and made a campaign that was not in support of the Democratic program as it had been carried out by Roosevelt and myself, but was based on the advertising and the Republican propaganda in which he thought that everything in Washington was crooked. Well, it wasn't. It's been conclusively proved. You take the time when Brownell made his terrible speech in Chicago, and when this fellow Veldy in New York, in Illinois, tried to upset the apple cart, they both got their ears knocked down. And later on, it was asserted by the Republican propagandists that George C. Marshall and myself were traitors. And I made the statement after that, if George Marshall and myself were traitors, the country was in a hell of a fix. And it would have been if that were the case. And it was offered by the then Republican chairman, who thought he'd run for governor in New York one time, that he'd give $1,000 if it could be proven that Nixon had called me a traitor. It was proven, and I told him to send the $1,000 to the Red Cross in Korea. It was never paid.
Now, you once said about Governor Warren, Earl Warren, that he was a Democrat but didn't know it.
Well,
how do you feel in the same way about Governor Stevens?
Well, I think he's a Republican and doesn't know it, because he's been raised in that atmosphere. He's not the successor of Adlai Stevenson to begin with, who was the vice president of Grover Cleveland. He's he owns a newspaper that's not ever been in the Democratic column, and I suppose that's what the trouble is. Now, I hate to say that, because I was very well and very highly impressed with him, but he didn't understand the maneuvers that go to make a leader of a party. My admiration for the Chief Justice has started when he was governor of California. I stopped in Sacramento, California about 7:30 in the morning. There were about 10,000 people behind the train at that time. This is on the famous whistle stop campaign. And the governor got on the train up in front and came back. And we sat and talked a while, and I said, "Well, Governor, I'll be glad to go back to the front of the train so you won't be embarrassed with these people behind the train here." And he said to me, "Mr. President, you're President of the United States. I'm the Governor of California. I'm going out there on that back platform and introduce you." And he did, and I never forgot it. And when he was Chief Justice, after he had been appointed Chief Justice, and the Republicans wanted to get him out of the way, and he's made a great Chief Justice, he came out here and dedicated this library of mine with President Hoover and Sam Rayburn and all the leaders of the Republicans and the Democrats. Even Halleck was here. And I want to say to you that there isn't a finer man in the United States than the Chief Justice. His name's Warren.
Mr. President, at one time you had thought of Vinson, Chief Justice Vinson, as a possible candidate.
That's right.
Tell us something about that.
Yes, I talked to Vinson about it down at Key West one time, and he told me that his ambition had been achieved when he became Chief Justice of the United States. That was the greatest honor that could come to any man, especially a lawyer, and that's what he was. And he made a great Chief Justice, and he told me that he didn't think he ought to be considered in that line. And he was right, of course. And I was for him. We only had one Chief Justice who ran for president, and he was defeated. His name was Hughes.
Did Chief Justice Vinson give you any political reasons for not wanting to risk it in 52?
No. He just was of the opinion that as the head of the judiciary in the United States, he shouldn't get into political.
Did he make any suggestions to you about whom else he would recommend to you?
No, he didn't recommend anybody. There was nobody in sight. And we had to figure this thing out and finally came to the conclusion that the governor of Illinois was the best man in sight because of his name and his background and the fact that he'd been elected governor in a Republican state by 500,000.
Mr. President, about 1956, the time in which there's still some controversial discussion about your picking on Governor Harriman, almost at the last stage. Can you give us a little bit of the background of your thinking which led up to that?
Well, the thing that really caused it was the fact that I had been informed that I was an albatross around the neck of the man who ordinarily would be renominated, as Bryan was in 1900 at Kansas City. So I got to thinking about the situation. I thought I'd be able to help both Harriman and Stevenson by saying that I thought that Harriman would make a good president. I thought he would. But I wanted to get myself in a position where I would not be a handicap to Stevenson because I knew he was going to be nominated.
In what way can you be a little more specific, Mr. President, how you felt you could help by that maneuver? In other words, that you would disassociate yourself from
it? Well, sure. If I was an albatross, I wanted to take it off his neck, that's all.
In other words, you deliberately took a public position which was unpopular and hurtful to you in order to remove yourself from Stevenson?
What I was interested in was to get a Democratic president in the White House. And I thought maybe that might help to do it. That's all there was to it. Didn't make any difference what had happened to me personally.
But
my reputation was either made or unmade long before that.
Didn't you feel, Mr. President, that the managers of the Democratic committee had maneuvered the convention in a way as to embarrass you needlessly?
No, I didn't think so. I didn't think so. If I was embarrassed, I embarrassed myself, and I didn't mind it.
No, but didn't they try to discount your position in the party to the point where they practically ignored it in connection with Stevens?
Well, no, I don't think so, because they didn't have a chance enough to think about it. You see, when they got in trouble on the platform, I made a statement on the platform, and then there wasn't a fight. So they agreed with what I had to say, but when it came time for me to make the announcement, the presiding officer, who was my good friend Sam Rayburn, begged me not to make it. I said, "Sam, this is my personal affair. You don't have to get mixed up in it." And it was then, the motion was then put by Sam as to whether the former president of the United States could address the convention. It takes unanimous consent if you're not a delegate. And Sam put the motion this way. He said, "The president of the United, former president of the United States, would like to address the convention. It requires unanimous consent. Is there objection?" I hear none. "Mr. President, you're recognized."
And that statement was to say that...
That I was for Harriman.
Yes.
And Sam knew that's what it was, and he didn't think it ought to be done.
Yes. And you did.
Because he was afraid it would embarrass me. Well, it didn't. Never embarrassed me. I got out then and worked for the committee and the party, and that's all there was to it.
Well, may I ask you, what was Harriman aware of what was in your mind? What was his feeling about it? Did he really think he might have a chance?
Yes, I think he did. I think he did, and he had a right to.
Yes.
He thought I had more influence with the Democratic Convention than I had. I knew I didn't have it.
No, it isn't. Wasn't it a fact that it was not your influence so much? Did you put your influence on the auction block in order to open the convention, which had been closed for any competition or any further nomination?
Well, of course, that helped. But then, as I say, the objective was to take Stevenson off the spot because I knew he was going to be nominated.
But even in 48, sir, you had the inside track, as a president always does, and yet you encouraged an open convention.
That's right.
Now,
that's
the
way it ought to always be. It ought to be an open convention.
But you found that in 52 it was not an open convention, that it was preset and prejudged, and Stevenson had it made.
No, he didn't. He didn't have it made. If I hadn't taken a plane and flown from Washington to Chicago, he wouldn't have been nominated.
No, that's in 52.
52.
But 56,
right. Sir. Oh, 56. He had the convention in control, which is all right. I didn't care. As I told you, the nominee of the party is the leader of the party, and that's what he ought to be. And he ought to be a coy, hesitant person about accepting that leadership. And that's what happened in 56. We had a hell of a time getting Stevens to say that he was even going to run.
Now, you said
in 56.
'56, you said. Well, he was running in states. He was in primaries, in a good many primaries.
He wouldn't tell any of us that he was going to run.
But then you said
so we could do something for it.
But you said at a press conference in Chicago that, in your judgment, Stevenson could not be elected. Now, what was your judgment based on, sir?
On the fact that he had lost by such a tremendous majority in the former 1952 campaign. And that he had not made an approach to the thing in the complete endorsement of the Democratic Party in principles. That's what the trouble was. And I was satisfied that if he were nominated again without having assumed the leadership of the Democratic Party, as he should have done after 1952, that he couldn't be elected. But I was perfectly willing to try to help elect him, which I did.
But in disassociating yourself from Stevenson, you also made a public statement that a lot of people, and columnists particularly, criticized, that you said he could not be elected when you knew he had to be nominated.
Yes, I said he couldn't be elected, basing it on the same statement I just now made. And I also, if you remember, had a phrase attached to that. He couldn't possibly be elected without the support of the old man that was talking at the press conference, and that was myself.
I thought you did make that.
You
make
that statement.
That's right.
And you also said that he wouldn't carry as many states in 56 as he carried in 52. Now, what was that based on?
On a survey of the situation, because I knew the halo was still working, so far as the military was concerned, just like it did for Grant. In fact, Grant almost was nominated in 1880. for a third term after they found out what a terrible administration he had.
And you felt that you saw no change at all in Stevenson in the vigor and
with which you would
conduct his campaign.
No, no, I didn't, and I was sorry. But I got out and did everything I could. And as I say, I got more disrespect in that 56 campaign than I had ever received from the time I started in politics.
Disrespect.
I was perfectly willing to accept it.
Disrespect from whom, Mr.?
Oh, the people in front of the car from which I was speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terrible thing.
Well, I was there on several of the tours, Mr. President. I don't seem to recall any of that.
Well, sir, if you remember...
Heckling. He had a lot of heckling.
If you remember, right north of New York one night, I forget the name of the town, they had brought out a whole string of school children, college kids, with instructions to go ahead and do what they could to break up the meeting. Well, they were having a football game or something that night, and I saw them all just to fill up the whole space behind the train, and I told them that I was very much interested in what they were trying to do. I knew that they wanted to be discourteous to the president, which was not very nice to do, but I was very much interested in who was going to win this game uptown. Where they were also interested in where they ought to be, hollering for their teams, and that if they'd get out of the way and let me finish my speech, I'd come up there and see if I couldn't help them to win. I never got a single boo.
Yes, the thing I'm trying to emphasize, Mr. President, that from what I have seen on those trips, you have been growing in the admiration of the public.
Well, I know that's true, but then the Republicans were hiring these kids at 50 cents a piece to come and be discourteous to the president, and that's absolutely wrong. I wouldn't allow, if I were in charge of the Democratic Party, I wouldn't allow that to happen to the worst enemy I ever had if he were in the presidency.
Now, in 1952, as the campaign progressed, the Democrats were gaining, the Democratic ticket was gaining, and there was a period when the Republicans were seriously worried until the thing came along, if elected, I'll go to Korea.
That's right.
Now, what happened in 56 that made it even easier for the Republican president to gain re-election?
I don't know. I don't know what really happened. There was no Korea at that time, although the surrender in Korea had already been made after 52, and he couldn't make another one. Another surrender like that, but I don't understand, except that people are inclined to be very friendly to a military hero.
Now then,
President Roosevelt and I built up this hero and made him, but he doesn't remember that.
Well, now, why is it that President Roosevelt and yourself, in all the time you had, couldn't find among the Democratic eligibles anybody who was an obvious front runner entitled to succeed to the presidency on the Democratic
ticket? I don't know. That's the thing I can't understand. One of the difficulties is always that a man at the top, when he's popular, has difficulty finding a successor. And that's true in any history of the country that you want to read. Jackson had difficulty. The man he did select didn't make good, although he was a good president. He didn't make good as a successor to Jackson. That's been true of Grant and all the rest of the men who have been elected on popularity contests. Of course, Woodrow Wilson was ruined by the irreconcilables and the lies they told on him. And I don't know what would have happened to Franklin Roosevelt had he been able to live and finish his fourth term. He probably would have had the same trouble that the rest of them did, but as his successor, when he died a short time after he was elected for the fourth term, it was possible for me to build up a situation which finally ended up with a re-election in 1948. I don't know what would have happened after that, because I had no intention of trying to serve more than two terms in the White House. It's a back-breaking proposition, and it's terrible on your family. And that's what I was thinking about. I thought I'd accomplish the things that I set out to accomplish, and I think I did. And then I had hoped that a successor would carry on from that point. We couldn't find him. Where the hell he was, I don't know.
Mr. President, I want to ask you just a sort of freakish question. Every president from 1840, taking every 20 years, 1840, 1860, 80, and down to 1940, who had been elected president, died in office either through death or assassination. Do you think 1960 holds any foreboding for anybody that way?
Oh, I hope not. I hope not. Those things were happenstance, of course. And I sincerely hope that nothing of the kind will happen. One of the most disastrous things that ever happened to the country was the assassination of Lincoln. Although I've always been of the opinion that if he'd lived,